Commander Cox has been on here before, and he's talked about, you know, Xi Jinping's long-term plan to have China dominate the world by 2035. To that end, he was just selected to an unprecedented third term as the leader of the Communist Party, okay? So his power is on an order as much as what Mao had. I mean, that's unbelievable, okay? So this guy is serious, and he's got the support of the Communist Party, which sort of takes us down, you know, a serious road when you think about the kinds of things he wants to accomplish, okay? Now, think about this. During Pelosi's visit during the summer to Taiwan, I think you saw, you know, a dress rehearsal of what is possible if Xi decides that, you know, Taiwan is such a problem for him that he's going to take care of this. And let me just, you know, reinforce, at this last Communist Party where he was just put up for an unprecedented third term, what did he say about Taiwan? We need to get this taken care of. It's important for the unity of China, okay? So having said that, you know, it seems to me that we need to be paying close attention to what he's doing to further that end, okay? Then I want to just give you a quick background. Here you have Biden meeting Xi in Bali. And what happened there? Now, I understand our concerns about Biden being compromised because of his family's dealing with China, okay? And I think that that's a real issue that hopefully these Republicans will take over as they take over, you know, the House, will start doing the real investigations that are necessary. But the reality is we all know it's true. So here's a problem. What does Biden say to Xi about human rights violations? What does he say about anything concerning fentanyl? Absolutely nothing, okay? He comes away from that Bali meeting putting on the best face about what's going on with China. And I think that it's important to note in a completely different approach that Trump saw that called China out and pushed China into a position where they knew that the United States was serious about the issues that Trump had put out. So with that as a brief introduction, Deke, thanks for coming on this morning. How are you doing?
We're doing great here in South Texas. How are you doing, Dr. Luke?
I didn't quite catch that last part.
I said, yeah, we're doing great here in South Texas. How are you doing this morning?
Oh, South Texas. Okay, well, we're doing great in Fairhope, and I wish you were here, I'll tell you that. But so listen, Deke, I mean, you are a serious student of what goes on in China. What I'd like to do this morning, if we could, is take this discussion into three phases, okay? The first phase will be the penetration of U.S. society by the Chinese, and we can go through a long discussion of that. Then I'd like you to take us to an update on the military buildup that they've had and what that entails in terms of our ability to do whatever is necessary to defend Taiwan, but also for power projection in Western Pacific. And then thirdly, I'd like to talk, if we have time, to talk some about the economic side of, you know, our relationship with China, okay? So if we can do that, let's just jump right into this penetration of U.S. society and give us some thoughts about, you know, let's put it this way. The FBI Director Wray said at a recent hearing that the Chinese penetration is of such a magnitude that it is his most important, you know, issue, and it's one of the most dangerous things we're dealing with. So can we kind of give the audience a sense of how that is actually happening and what we're talking about this quote-unquote penetration?
Sure. So the audience may recall that where we left off in our last discussion about China and its interference and subversion in U.S. domestic politics and economics, political affairs. You know, we can look at FBI and, you know, Mr. Wray's testimony to Congress and quickly see the lie in it, and the fact that, you know, that along with other issues that we've been dealing with the FBI and their corruption, that they're not really serious. You know, when the director of the FBI sits there and tells Congress that, you know, that he is concerned about China being the most direct threat to and penetration of the United States, he's only stating the obvious, right? Most people, I think, at this point understand that. But when we look at the recent arrest of, for instance, Eugene Yu with Conic Corporation, which was an election software company that was based out of Michigan State University and was working with the Confucius Institute there, which is a CCP, PRC body, on the campus of Michigan State University back in the early 2000s, as he built out this election software company. You know, it was an absolute mission of the Chinese Ministry of State Security, the MSS, to subvert U.S. elections. They saw this long-term as their ability to install the Manchurian candidates that they wanted, and Joe Biden is a classic example of that, but there are many at this point, where they can manipulate elections and install the people that they want that are going to give them the leftist, progressive, socialist, communist outcomes that they seek. And so when we look at Eugene Yu's arrest last month, who was he arrested by, Lou? He was arrested by not the FBI, who's in charge of domestic law enforcement, okay, but he was actually arrested by Gascon, the DA of Los Angeles, and, you know, that made no sense whatsoever because, you know, we know that Gascon is a George Soros-funded district attorney, and that he has one of the most radical and leftist progressive agendas in all of law enforcement and in the entire country. And so why would Gascon go after Eugene Yu if not to protect him and, you know, keep, for instance, a red state attorney general, you know, let's say Florida or Alabama, okay, from arresting him and then putting him under deposition, you know, which was right before the election. It was all very much structured, if you know what I'm saying. And
sure.
So, you know, that's a classic example, and unfortunately recent, of, you know, highlighting the absolute bald-faced lies that are being told to the American people by our own government.
Well, I mean, it seems like with the FBI raid saying these kinds of, you know, statements about how dangerous all this is, then you have danger, you know, in the election system. It's just a wink and a nod. You know, we're doing something, but then you turn it over to Gascon. So I guess the real question is, at this point, you know, we have got to follow what Gascon is doing and making sure that the public understands that this wink and a nod is nothing more than just the ability of the Communist Chinese Party to get their way in the United States. And I know that there are other examples of it. So can you want to just kind of develop a few other examples of just how they've been able to manipulate, you know, our system? I mean, to the point where, you know, you mentioned Confucius Institutes. Well, I mean, Alabama had two of them, and only one of them has been closed down. So, I mean, at what point do we start recognizing that these institutes are part and parcel of an attempt to try to move the culture, you know, and move the political process in a way that's detrimental to American interests?
Yeah, I agree 100%. And, you know, bringing that back to Alabama, we've discussed, for instance, Governor Ivey's ties to the Golden Dragon Copper Tubing Company, you know, that she helped set up in Hitchcock County, which is where she's from. And then, you know, we look at the Secretary of State and his, cozy relationship, to put it mildly, with a likely Ministry of State Security spy, okay, in Spring Nazoe, okay, dating back into, 2015, 2016, she's no longer employed by the state of Alabama. She took a cozy job up in New York City working for an investment house up there. But she was active in the Alabama state government for 5 years in two different administrations, and yet no eyebrows were raised, no questions were asked. And it really begs the question of, you know, just who knew what and how bad is it? And so, you know, I'm not one to, you know, talk about these grievances that we have without offering solutions. And so, you know, one of the things that we hear frequently from, you know, people in Common Sense Campaign and our fellow citizens, you know, around is, well, gosh, what can we do? And what I would offer, you know, to the listening audience and to the electorate, to our fellow citizens, is, you know, we are in a period, and we've been there for a couple of years now since COVID was foisted upon us. But going forward, folks, we have to be able to appeal to our state leadership, namely the district attorney, all the way down to our local sheriffs, and solidify the relationship that we, the citizens, have with our law enforcement, with our state militia, you know, the Alabama Guard, and with the, you know, state's attorney, so that we make sure that they hear our concerns and take action. You know, that if there's direct evidence, for instance, okay, let's talk about Spring Nazo. If we have direct evidence that you know, that she was you know, involved in nefarious activities on behalf of the Chinese Communist Party and the Chinese state, you know, then we should be able to, you know, appeal to our Attorney General, you know, Steve Marshall, and ask for, you know, a grand jury investigation or the issuance of a warrant, you know, to bring her to justice, right? And then, you know, let justice run its course and then deport her, okay? But we are at a point now where, you know, so much of the federal government is shot through with corruption. You know, some of the readers, you know, and listening audience may have seen the interview on American Thought Leaders on October 29th, you know, where they were interviewing, you know, a longtime China hand who worked with Kissinger, and basically, you know, it was a mea culpa. It was an admission of just how complicit the U.S. government has been over decades in building out, you know, the Chinese Communist Party. But we have to be able to, you know, the recourse that we have at our disposal is to use our local and state law enforcement to pursue charges against these people, to conduct investigations. And if it's seen or found that they broke the law in Alabama or corruption was evident, you know, and that person is under suspicion, you know, transits Alabama or is in a nearby state, then we need to be able to work with other red state attorney general and to be able to put out a bench warrant to have that person taken into custody and brought to justice in the state of Alabama. You know, this is a time and for a number of years going forward where we are going to have to fall back on the 10th Amendment of the U.S. Constitution and really push forward with states' rights to be able to bring these people to justice. For instance, you know, Hunter Biden. You know, we know, for instance, that, you know, he was caught absolutely red-handed when his laptop turned up a few years ago. But, of course, the mainstream media, you know, denied it. And it never even saw the light of day in published media articles. And so, you know, the evidence there is overwhelming that he was breaking laws and trafficking drugs and you know, the consumption of illegal substances. You know, firearm violations, right. You know, other corruption where he was taking payoffs from known entities of the Chinese Communist Party. And, you know, and then we're all familiar, most of us anyway, with the, you know, 10 for the big guy, right? 10% for the big guy. And we all know who the big guy is. It's his father, Joe Biden. And so, you know, we should be able to appeal to our attorneys general to either, you know, find a law within Alabama that applies to bring these people to justice. And if it doesn't exist currently in the Alabama code, then convene the legislator and you know, let's come up with a law, develop laws that allow us to bring these people to justice, because that is how we begin.
Well, let me ask you this. I mean, I don't think there's any question about what you just said has to be done, okay? But that's, you know, cases where you've got like Swallow spy and Feinstein spy and, you know, what's going on here, those kinds of are kind of cut and dry. But what about these issues where the Confucius Institutes are just injecting into the culture through TikTok, things like that, a narrative that is inimical to the American interests and trying to persuade people that China's good and blah, blah, blah. I mean, it seems like that gray area is a little bit more difficult to deal with, and Trump at least had the common sense to take TikTok on and Huawei. I mean, here again, those two entities seem to be, you know, part and parcel of this movement towards something really nefarious, but now you've got Biden in charge. They've backed off of Trump's China Institute business, where they were actually trying to dig into what's going on. So, I mean, is this, again, one of these questions where, you know, we have to just keep trying to mobilize people and keep them informed, but when the government is not serious about what's going on because they're compromised, I mean, where does that leave us?
Well, it goes back to the, you know, to that doozy, another doozy from FBI Director Wray, where they very quietly entered into the Federal Register that they were, you know, choosing not to enforce, you know, the Trump administration standard on, you know, some of the bans, the technological bans and the trade right. bans that had been implemented, you know, with China. They, you know, the first year and a half of the Biden administration, they were very slow to, you know, to make public statements about that. They kept them in place. Everybody knew it was the right thing to do. But then under pressure from Chinese interests, you know, such as the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, hey, here's one for you that's been bought off, okay? The Chinese U.S. Education Foundation, known as CUSIF, okay? Several of these are very active up in New York City and in the New York area, you know, in and around the U.N., which is a bed of CCP spy activity. And, you know, and so this, you know, when we see FBI Director Wray sit up there again in front of Congress and say that, you know, talk about, you know, being serious on China, but yet, you know, they've secretly within, and, you know, only 2 or 3 weeks prior to that, you know, canceled, you know, standing efforts to have a commission take a hard look at Chinese penetration of the U.S. government and of U.S. society. You know, it's only too obvious that the FBI is also bought off as well. And so, you know, back to the point, you know, you ended with the question of, well, what can we do? You know, and that, again, until we're able to sort out U.S. elections, which is going to take a decade or more, okay, of constant vigilance and, you know, working state by state, you know, to implement, for instance, the type of change that we saw Ron DeSantis achieve in Florida, you know, not to mention the fact that, you know, there's this whole other trend that's running throughout the U.S. politic where, you know, we've got really a uniparty, okay? You know, it's so hard to distinguish Republicans from Democrats these days. I mean, look at our own Jerry Carl, okay? When was the last time that we saw him, heard him stand up and make a forceful statement about Chinese Communist Party penetration of the U.S. political establishment, of, you know, of the corruption of U.S. technical standards, of the obvious problems that we have with still a Confucius Institute active in the state of Alabama? You know, where is Jerry Carl on these issues?
Well, I think that was my next point. I mean, if we're seeing that the executive branch is bought out, which I think is pretty much a clear case, then the fact that McCarthy has talked about, you know, moving hard against China. You and I talked about this. He's supposed to be having a subcommittee that's going to be exclusively dealing with the Chinese problems. So once again, we're relying on the Republicans to do things that they say they're going to do, but as it was in 2010 after they took over, and 2014 they took the Senate in 2014, they did nothing to stop Obama. And so I think the likelihood that we're going to have a repeat of 2010, 2014 is extremely high. And given that, that puts us right back to local politics where, you know, our representative, as you say, is Jerry Carl. Well, where is he going to go on this? And I think that for our audience, you know, he is going to be at the think tank that Cody Phillips had and now Mike Summerall has. And I think it's going to be important for us to bring these issues up to him so that, you know, the local understanding is that China is a threat and we expect the Republicans to take this threat seriously and do the hard work that's necessary, even if it looks unpopular to some. But whether or not they're going to do that again, I mean, Deke, the reality is that they have not lived up to what we have expected in 2010 and 2014. And guess what? You've got these never-Trumpers out there who don't want anything to do with Trump, who at least had the right, you know, policy choices on this question of China. So, I don't know. I mean, this penetration issue, you know, goes beyond just the things that we've talked about. You and I talked the other day about Sequoia. How is it possible that a venture capitalist company is now moving in the direction to support the Chinese with funding on a whole range of issues, including their military, including dual use issues? I mean, what's your take on that, and how does that fit in to this overall threat assessment that we seem to be just sticking our head in the sand on it?
Well, for a number of years, we have seen, you know, the Trump administration taking, you know, good and appropriate action and you know, levying tariffs on China, you know, putting, you know, known bad actors from the CCP and Chinese national companies and corporations on the entity list, you know.
Yeah.
You know, we've seen, you know, increased activity through Treasury, you know, where they would sit down and they would actually conduct a more rigorous technology, you know, review when a Chinese company had made an offer or a tender offer to purchase U.S. interest corporation.
Right.
So, you know, that those are all very good and needed steps, and you know, really, you could look at some of them at the time as really being warm milk, you know, but they were substantial in that they were finally, you know, setting an edge on U.S. policy, you know, to be able to begin turning the tide and taking action against some of these malfactor actors and just people and entities within the Chinese Communist Party that were actively trying to subvert U.S. economic interests and you know, and like we've already talked about, the political interests. But, you know, it really goes back to, you know, the question right now, which is that with the current administration, you know, they literally have given the green light to, you know, to Wall Street and to these different investment houses that are populated by panda huggers, okay, where, you know, where they might have been exercising caution and operating under a caution light, okay, under the Trump administration, man, it has changed yet again. You know, all those gains that we had seen in 2017, 2018, 2019, you know, have basically been peeled away one by one, and now, you know, you get these large investment houses that have been green-lighted yet again to you know, return capital and foreign direct investment into China. And so, you know, that must be stopped yesterday.
Well, Deke, I think that, you know, you're on the right track with that. There's no question about it. The next question is really going to be, how are we going to make this happen with McCarthy supposedly, you know, working on a China subcommittee? Are we going to have the right people, you know, going to Washington to testify and do what you're doing right now? I mean, just within your group of former intelligence folks, do you expect that some of them will be called up? I mean, do they have that influence with these policymakers in the House so that we can get these kinds of, you know, clear-headed views before the McCarthy subcommittee on China?
Well, the folks that that I know that are sharp on these issues and current, you know, are really, you know, they had, for instance, reconstituted the Committee on the Present Danger, which was a reincarnation of what we had in place during the Cold War to combat the Soviet Union.
Yeah.
That was reconstituted about 4 years ago. And, you know, for instance, Captain Jim Fennell, you know, former director of the Pacific Fleet Intelligence Directorate, you know, is on that committee, you know, the Committee for the Present Danger, China.
Uh-huh.
It was reconstituted under the last administration. And that's one of the ways that we begin, you know, expanding the messaging and expanding, you know, the sharing of fact, you know, so that we can, you know, better influence policy. Now, when we talk about McCarthy as Speaker of the House, you know, I have so little faith in him. You know, his record on China is not good. You know, the fact that he would, you know, name true hawks, which is an overused term, but realists, let's just say that, realists on China, you know, to any committee on China is really going to be the litmus test on just how serious they are. And,
yeah.
And, you know, anybody who's familiar with Washington knows that that really is, you know, the signal about how serious the political, you know, entities are about addressing any question, you know, but especially a hot potato like the Chinese problem with, you know, who they name to the committee, will they conduct hearings, what are their guidelines and bylaws, you know, for operating that committee. Does the committee have subpoena power? You know, it is. These are really the hallmarks of, you know, whether or not, you know, a Republican House marginally, okay, is serious about China. What I would encourage our listeners to, you know, to do is, you know, engage with our elected representatives, you know, and even expand that and write to, you know, other elected representatives and the Congress and Senate.
The whole Alabama delegation.
What your priorities are as a voter, as a citizen, because, you know, we're running out of time here, folks. You know, when we look 3 or 4 years down the road, you know, it's not looking good. You know, there are different entities out there, and the Chinese Communist Party is one of them, and one of the worst. You know, but when we look at what's going on with, you know, with the UN and you know, the WEF and the WHO and, you know, for instance, if, you know, Macron again yesterday at the APEC summit, you know, which followed their meeting in Bali, you know, last week, you know, Emmanuel Macron, president of France, gets up and they're in public for all to see, makes yet another call for, you know, a one world order, a new world order. You know, and so what I would encourage our listeners to be keen on is to, you know, continuing to do the diligent, you know, fact checks, which is an overused term, but, you know, really dig into the issues, you know, and then understand that, you know, that there are different entities pulling at the United States of America right now. And you know, if we'd had this conversation even 2 or 3 years ago, the conversation would have been about, you know, the wringing of hands of, oh goodness, is China going to surpass America? Well, understand, people, that under Xi Jinping and the Chinese Communist Party, they do not just want to surpass America; they want to destroy the United States of America. You know, we represent freedom and independent thought and individual rights. And democracy, right? True democracy. And that is, you know, the absolute anathema to the Chinese Communist Party and their totalitarian system. And we have to make a stand against this right now, while we still have time.
Well, I couldn't agree more with you. I mean, that's just this penetration question. You know, I wanted to start with the penetration question because, you know, it's kind of underneath the radar to a certain degree, and yes, some people are aware of it, but the reality is that without someone like Trump doing the things he did, the penetration questions goes by the by. I mean, we saw what happened with the WHO, their own, it's bought and paid for by the Chinese Communist Party. We see all this business with all these Chinese students in our universities. I mean, so it's on and on and on, and I think that, you know, your analysis of the penetration is something that would be helpful as we try to alert people to what's going on, okay? So let me just shift now to our second topic, which was the Chinese military buildup and the degree to which, you know, and we've had this conversation before a few months ago, where, you know, that buildup does present an existential threat to our ability to project power into the Western Pacific and do what's necessary for our own interests as well as the interests of those people who are aligned with us, South Korea, Japan, Taiwan. So can you just take us through, you know, a thumbnail briefing of the key parts of their military buildup that are part and parcel of this existential threat that I just mentioned?
Yes. So in addition to, you know, Michael Pillsbury's, you know, the 100-year marathon, in that interview that he gave to Epoch Times and American Thought Leaders on October 29th, you know, I would also recommend Daniel Estulin's book on any of his books, really, but especially his book on the Bilderberg Group, and then also the recent interview the interview that he gave with Germ Warfare. You can look it up online. But, you know, to lead into the discussion about military, you know, those discussions help shape our understanding and expectations of what China is really after, right, what they have achieved to date. And, you know, and with Xi's ascendancy to a third term, or its continuance into a third term as the paramount leader of the Chinese Communist Party, you know, he removed, a lot of people don't, you know, may not have been paying attention, but he removed the only three members of the Standing Politburo, the Politburo Standing Committee, who were deeply steeped in economic theory and markets. And so in place of those three, he now has, you know, a full war cabinet in place. And this was emphasized by the removal of the former president, Hu Jintao, you know, during the closing session, yeah, of the you know, the Chinese Congress Party, you know, last month, and which was a shocking thing to see. But that shows you the paramount power that Xi Jinping has. So when we talk about Taiwan, it's really just a question of understanding, you know, that Xi Jinping certainly has the military capability, no matter what anybody says, you know, to try and assuage our concerns. He absolutely has the military capability to take Taiwan at any minute. Okay, if he decided that he wanted it tomorrow morning, you know, he could make an effort. And you know, as we've seen over the many decades with the murderous Communist Party, they don't care whether they lose 10,000 or 10 million if their objective is obtained. And you know, we saw the same thing with their interventions in North Korea and Vietnam. And, you know, and then their, you know, expansionist activities over the many decades since 1949, where they have just, you know, by gun, at the barrel of a gun, or through just sheer numbers, have been able to subvert nation after nation and people after people on their borders. So when we look at Taiwan, what I would encourage our listeners to understand is that we will have very little to no warning when Xi Jinping decides that it's go time to go invade Taiwan. The numbers at this point, Lou, are so lopsided in his favor, and especially in the time distance calculations about massing of forces and you know, points of embarkation at Fuzhou and, you know, near Kinmen Island and others, right, is that, you know, he can put enough boots in the air, on the ground, on ships, and it doesn't matter how many we sink. The sheer volume and number of their onslaught is going to be a real problem in the defense of Taiwan, and what increasingly is looking like it may just be the United States and Japan, you know, standing with the Taiwanese. And so, you know, I am concerned, you know, especially when you just look at their the PLA rocket forces and their ability to shape the battle space, to force standoff with any U.S. carrier task force that's sent from 7th Fleet, their ability to fire multiple anti-ship cruise missiles at any interloper, as they see it, whether it be Japanese or, American, they can mount such a fierce in their offensive operations that, it is really a question of, who wants Taiwan the most. And even if you wanted it more, you may not be able to overcome those numbers. We've talked about it in the past that they, the PLA Navy and their maritime militia, their Coast Guards, now outnumber the U.S. Navy by at least 4 or 5 to 1, if not more. And, and so they have completely, grown their numbers to be able to dominate that space. And it's going to be a real challenge for us to operate in that battle area, any kind of a joint operating area, even east of Taiwan, when they've got those kind of numbers in the water, not to mention the fact that they now have a, rapidly maturing space-based intelligence collection architecture for imagery and radar coverage, and other capabilities that they didn't even have 20 years ago. And so that's where we are right now as of November 2022.
Okay. Well, let's just take a look at the classic approach to deterrence is to create a situation where the possibility of an aggression against point A or point B has become problematic for the aggressor. Okay. Now, I suggested in my letter to my Marine buddies during the Marine Corps birthday period there on November 10th, that what we should be doing is looking at possibly building up an American force on Taiwan, just as we have on South Korea. I mean, at the 38th parallel, that's a trigger point, and so far it has been a deterrence to any kind of attempts to take over South Korea. So if we look at that in terms of doing something to move, our forces there, yes, they're kind of, stuck out there. It sounds like the Marines at Guadalcanal in 42, but the fact of the matter is they may be able to at least, make Xi Jinping think twice about doing this, number one. And number two, by moving certain elements of our defensive capability, whether it's the Iron Dome or whatever, to make it that much more difficult for the Chinese Communist Party to just have its will there. I mean, is that something that we could contemplate and then, use our own standoff, capabilities to inflict damage, sufficient damage to make it a higher price for China to go after Taiwan? I mean, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, Lou, there is absolutely a place for strategic deterrence and for tactical deterrence in this discussion. The real concern and question at this point is whether or not the current administration and the, absolutely ridiculous Secretary of Defense and Lloyd Austin and, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs and General Milley, have the wherewithal and the guts, not to mention the political direction from the White House,
right,
actually implement a strategic strategy and communicating, that there is a severe cost to pay, for the Chinese Communist Party if they want to continue to push for Taiwan. And so, when we boil that down to the tactical level, I want to emphasize to our listening audience that any discussion about the use of tactical nuclear weapons or any nuclear weapon is a very, very serious discussion. And it is really unfortunate and disappointing to hear the loose talk from the current administration and the occupants of the White House and the way that they glibly talk about, Ukraine going nuclear and that, and NATO being brought into that, right? And so when we look at Taiwan, you know, we, you know, it's like this crazy juxtaposition between Ukraine and Taiwan, where, you know, the tactical option, you know, for tactical deterrence, you know, absolutely must be telegraphed to the Chinese about, you know, our willingness to use tactical nuclear weapons and then also strategic nuclear weapons as deterrence. Now, that's not talk of a madman, okay? I haven't lost my mind, you know, as someone who was active, you know, in you know, rode nuclear submarines in the first part of my Navy career, you know, I get strategic deterrence, okay? I understand what it's about. And, you know, we have to make sure that, that Xi Jinping and the Chinese Communist Party understand, bar none, that the 1950s policy of no mainland strikes with nuclear weapons, you know, is long gone. Like that, you know, like they are absolutely on the table if China crosses our red line. You know, everybody always wants to make a big deal about Chinese red lines, but, you know, we have to draw lines for them and make sure that they understand that we're serious about our nuclear strategic deterrence, including the fact that mainland strikes are on the table, and that includes, yes, Beijing, Shanghai, any of their major, you know, military operating areas, and all the way down to tactical nuclear weapons. You know, now, you know, it's been a long time since the American public has had to even stomach questions about that in an active debate. But, you know, we need to be prepared. You know, if we're really serious about defending Taiwan, we have to have that as one of the tools in our toolkit.
Well, I mean, I think you're absolutely right about that. But this is going to turn on the question of, does Taiwan really constitute, you know, a national interest of such significance that we're ready to do, you know, whatever we have to do in order to prevent its downfall? I mean, you know, you can look at the same question about Israel. I mean, and it seems like, you know, as you said earlier, we've had these kind of, you know, discussions about, you know, if Putin pops a nuke in Ukraine, what are we supposed to do? I've said on the show before that there's no way that we should be even thinking about using nuclear weapons in Ukraine. And what we can do is just to, you know, put more conventional forces in there to make them pay a higher price. The fact that the Iron Dome is not deployed into, you know, Ukraine to make them really pay a heavy price for all of their attacks with missiles and all like that is indicative, in my view, of a lack of seriousness, which is only going to create more problems for us, because it's going to be attempt that Putin will be tempted to use whatever he has to do. And the guy who's running this thing is the same guy who did the Syrian, you know, destruction. That guy was brought in to do exactly what he's doing now, the latest bombing raids and missile raids and all like that. So it seems to me that we're kind of at a crossroads in terms of defining what the national interest is. And when it pertains to Taiwan, there is this question about strategic ambiguity, which, you know, has kind of crept into the dialogue. But, I mean, at the same time, we have strategic ambiguity. We also have Biden going on TV, and I think the last time was on some CBS station, basically saying, hey, we're going to defend Taiwan. Well, I mean, if that's the case, then it seems like we better start doing something to make that defense possible instead of having China take this thing in a very quick way, and then we've got to fight to get it back, which I don't know. I mean, it just seems like we're at a crossroads in so many ways, in so many of the things that we're doing that don't make strategic sense, because we've never really come to grips with, you know, are we willing to trade, you know, Los Angeles for Shanghai if it comes to that? I don't know. I mean, what are your thoughts about that? What is the people on the Clear and Present Danger Committee? What are their thoughts on this?
Well, I can't speak for the CPDC as a non-member, but you know what I can say is that, you know, that ergo previous discussions, Lou, you know, that we've got real concerns. You know, I don't think that our national security strategy services the growing need and urgency over Taiwan, right? It just doesn't.
Yeah.
Strategic ambiguity had its time and place. Those days are past. You know, we are in a position with China where we must signal the strategic deterrence that we hold. China certainly understands this, because just in the last 6 months, we've received confirmation of long-standing concerns that the Chinese were probably engaged in a multi-decade generational improvement and upgrade to their strategic nuclear forces. And you know, for years, you know, the U.S. national intelligence community didn't want to talk about it, or would Pushaw, or culture cancel, you know, anybody that stood up to speak forthrightly about that. And you know, and now, you know, publicly they've come out and acknowledged that, oh yeah, we don't know how the Chinese got suddenly 300 new land-based, you know, ICBM silos out in the middle of the Gobi Desert and elsewhere. You know, it is one of the most egregious intelligence failures that the American public does not know about, that has just been made public, but of course no media outlet is going to even cover the story. And so it is an appalling lapse of intelligence indications and warning, because now when push comes to shove over, for instance, Taiwan, or it could be, India, who knows, that, likely to be Taiwan would be my guess, is that, we're going to be woefully unprepared to have that strategic deterrence discussion.
Yeah.
And, I think that it's a real problem. And, as to is Taiwan international interest, well, given the fact that they produce roughly half or more of the world's semiconductors, which drive huge portions of our economy in communications and entertainment and, automotive needs, there is an argument, a strong argument to be made just from U.S. interest, not to mention coalition interest with our Japanese allies, that, that strategically, of course, Taiwan is critical to a bulwark in the defense of the Japanese southern islands, which, again, treaty ally with Japan. We have a treaty with them to help defend Japan in the time of aggression, against them. It's very important that we have that discussion. And whether or not, the coin, turns heads up and, in favor of enhancing and our communication and telegraphing of strategic deterrence to China, is really, it's up in the air right now. And me personally,
right,
I don't know about you, but, I'm not satisfied with that answer. I think that we need to have a more serious discussion about strategic deterrence as well as tactical deterrence against China, and, move beyond this discussion about, ambivalence.
Well, Deke, I think I'm running out of time now, so I think you closed it nicely with that last summary. And I think that, this discussion is certainly going to be continued, and we'll have you back, probably after we hear from Jerry Call to see what he says. So, Deke, thank you so much. You take care over there in Texas, and stay warm. Hopefully you won't have a repeat of that Texas freezing weather like you had a couple of years ago. Take care, Deke.
All right. Thanks, Doc.
Sure, babe. Take care. All right, folks. Here we are. A minute to go. Mark's looking at the clock. And I have to say, thank you, Judd. Appreciate your help with this. I think all of us need to recognize this question about the national interest and what's taking place in Taiwan. Clearly, if we let the Chinese take over Taiwan, it is going to be a signal that they can take over the rest of Asia. And so, do we want to wait until they've done that before we confront them? I don't know. Biden comes back from Bali basically saying, hey, everything's copacetic. We're just competitors. BS. It's ridiculous. Okay? So here we are. I'll see you all next week. Have a great Thanksgiving. Lots to be thankful for. Take care. See you next week. Bye.
And you've been listening to the Conservative Watchdog Weekly News Review, brought to you by Dr. Lou Campomenosi, president of the Common Sense Campaign, adjunct professor of political science at Spring Hill College, brought to you by Kevin Spriggs Enterprises, featuring the Shell station in Malbus with a state-of-the-art car wash and car washes in Malbus at Shell Street and Highway 98 and Highway 90.